Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Klamath Tribes podcast. Today, the big man is in the house. Chairman Clay Dumont is joining us, as well as the water lawyer, as we're calling him, Jay Weiner. Jay, welcome to the show, and Chairman Dumont.
Detroitus.
Jay, you've got a lot of responsibility in these days of legalities in the Upper Klamath Basin with water. Want to give a little background on yourself and where you're at with the work with the tribes?
I would be happy to, Ken, and Chairman, thank you very much for inviting me on. I've been working for the Klamath Tribes for a little over 7 years now, and primarily for the tribes, I work on Endangered Species Act cases, specifically trying to protect and preserve the Tuaman Koptu, as well as the enforcement of the Klamath Tribes' water rights claims that have been decreed in the Klamath Basin adjudication.
Very good. And Chairman Dumont, where are we going today? What are the topics you want to focus on? There's a lot on your agenda.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. I really just wanted to give our members some insight into the state of things as far as the politics around the management of lake levels, Upper Klamath Lake, where things are as far as the Endangered Species Act and the various parts of that. And I also really wanted to introduce them to Jay, who's being modest. He's far more than a water lawyer. This guy is a big time star when it comes to the courtroom. I've had opportunity to watch now for about 5 years, and I would not trade Jay or any of our legal team for any of those that I've seen opposing us. I think most of our members know that I spent about three decades in academic circles, mostly with university professors. Jay is, you know, among a handful of the most intellectually capable human beings I've ever run across. But more importantly, he cares deeply. This is not just a job for him. He really has a heart for us, for the Klamath Tribes, for our culture, and for our homeland. So it's long past time that he had an opportunity to speak on what he does and for our members to hear from him. So that's the other part of what I wanted to do today.
The Department of Interior has granted $72 million for restoration work as well. You're involved with that. Is that all tied together with what, when you talk about water?
Absolutely it is. So the Department of Interior, under the leadership of Secretary Holland, has sent out Deputy Assistant Secretary for Fish and Wildlife, Matthew Strickler, who has been pulling together irrigators, downriver tribes, Klamath tribes, in some cases counties and the state at regular meetings. We meet now once a month over in Ashland to try to work our way through these perennial problems that we've got here and struggles over water. The current administration is very aware, and I think that the Klamath tribes have been quite successful in pushing the view that the only way out of the water predicaments we have now is through restoration of the ecosystem. That if tribes are going to be able to hold on to our culture, if that our fish are going to continue living, and if there's going to be any future for the agricultural community, it all revolves around some sort of semblance of health for the ecosystem. It's the only way that we go forward. So that's what we're working at. And those first $72 million hopefully are just the beginning.
From a legal standpoint, what are our challenges, Jay?
So thank you, Ken. And first, let me just thank Chairman Dumont very much for those kind words. You can't see me blushing on the phone, but that praise means a tremendous amount to me. And it is just an honor and a privilege for me that the tribes trust me to do this work on their behalf. And I do care very deeply about it. And it means a lot to me to be able to fight, particularly for the preservation of the Tuam and the Koptu. Obviously, I am not a tribal member and don't have the same relationship with those two fish, but I am acutely aware of both how existentially important they are to the Klamath tribes and the Klamath people and how precariously and critically endangered they are. And so, Ken, really, first and foremost, from a legal standpoint, we have, for a long time, the Klamath tribes have not been satisfied with the attention that the Bureau of Reclamation, other federal agencies, other water users in the Klamath Basin have been paying to the needs of the Tuam and Koptu, particularly in Upper Klamath Lake, which is really their last stronghold on the face of the planet. And one of my primary roles for the tribe is utilizing the legal tools that we have available to us, which at this point in time is predominantly the Endangered Species Act, to do everything possible to ensure that the biological needs of these species to remain in existence and ultimately to be able to recover to levels where Klamath tribal members can harvest them again, which I know hasn't been able to happen since 1986. That is really the overarching goal here. And the legal arena in which I battle on the tribe's behalf is just a piece of the overall effort that will be necessary to make those things happen.
Yeah. So, Jay, I wonder if you might say a little bit about the recent court decision that came down affirming the magistrate judge's recommendations.
Absolutely, Chairman. And so the suit the chairman is referring to is a lawsuit that the Klamath tribes brought in 2022 invoking the Endangered Species Act because in 2022, which was the third consecutive really bad water year in the Klamath Basin, Reclamation made the unconscionable decision that while it could not meet the minimum biological needs for the Tuam and Koptu and Upper Klamath Lake, it decided to use that as an excuse to instead give extra water to Klamath Project irrigators. And that runs directly in the face of the paramount importance of the Endangered Species Act, which is placed on preventing the extinction of endangered species. And it was unfortunately, it was frustrating that this was a lawsuit that had to be brought in the first place. But the tribes directed me to bring this lawsuit challenging Reclamation for this abject failure to live up to its obligations to the Tuam and Koptu under the Endangered Species Act. And we pursued that case at sort of a slightly complicated procedural basis, which is that we first went and got heard by a federal magistrate judge who is an appointed official who can sometimes stand in the shoes of the sort of what you think of as a regular judge, but usually hears matters before they get to the regular judge. And so we fought this case out first in front of Magistrate Judge Clark over in Medford, and he issued his decision in the tribe's favor last summer, finding that, yes, Reclamation had indeed violated its obligations to the Tuam and Koptu, and that it could not be giving water to Klamath Project irrigators when the minimum needs of the Tuam and Koptu, as they were determined by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, were not being met. And once the magistrate judge entered his order, there was an opportunity for our opponents, the United States Department of Justice and Klamath Project water users, to essentially appeal that decision up to Judge Mike McShane out of, I believe he is in Portland. And he had an opportunity to hear the objections that were brought to Magistrate Judge Clark's ruling. We fought those and indicated why we thought Magistrate Judge Clark got it right. And ultimately, earlier this month, a couple of weeks ago, Judge McShane agreed that Magistrate Judge Clark got it right on all counts and that the Klamath tribes were correct that Reclamation had not done what it was supposed to do under the Endangered Species Act. And I think the really important thing that that case stands for is that it reaffirms that the needs of the Tuam and Koptu have to take priority over the needs of the irrigators when there's not enough water to go around.
Yeah, that was absolutely huge to get that ruling. There's a bit of a dilemma, I think, now for the tribal leadership and the tribal legal team as we work in these meetings that I described a moment ago to get the very best conditions possible for the recovery of our fish going forward. And that is that the case, and you correct me where I'm wrong, Jay, was really built around some lake level minimums that were part of the biological opinion that Reclamation violated in its management of the lake. Specifically, 4142 is a lake level elevation for spring spawning in April. And when Reclamation decided that they couldn't meet that level, they decided, well, we can't meet it. There's another target later in the summer, which is lower. So we're going to go ahead and ship water to the irrigators, and we'll worry about the next target since we can't meet this one. Now, there is early on in the discussions about what's called a proposed action, which will come from BOR and then will bring environmental assessments from not just Fish and Wildlife, but also from National Marine Fisheries, who's responsible for a biological opinion on the river governing threatened coho. And the new approach that Fish and Wildlife is looking at and that BOR is looking at for managing the lake at this point doesn't necessarily have that lake level minimum in the spring. That's far from set, and we've let Fish and Wildlife know as recently as yesterday that when we get to the biological opinion level beyond merely the PA, the proposed action, that we're going to have to see some kind of firm numbers in there. So the court case is built on the fact that there was a firm number. The changes in the way that they want to conceptualize managing the lake, I think, are overall positive. But then we've got this omission of a spring level for spawning that is very troubling for us. And maybe you can help shore up the things that I've missed there, Jay.
No, I think, Chairman, that was a very good summary of where we are. I guess the one thing I might offer is just that those are a bunch of terms that I was going to use also in terms of biological opinion and proposed action. And the reason that those are terms that we use is that the way that this works in terms of the Endangered Species Act is that when a federal agency, in this case Reclamation, is going to do something, in this case operate the Klamath Irrigation Project, that will potentially adversely affect species that are listed under the Endangered Species Act. So we have Chulmunkaptu in Upper Klamath Lake, as well as coho salmon in the Klamath River. Reclamation, the action agency, so Reclamation, puts together a proposed action saying, here is what we intend to do. It conducts its own biological assessment of that action, which is, here is what we think the effects on listed species, on threatened and endangered species, will be, and here is why we think that those effects are okay, that they will not drive those species extinct or prevent them from recovering to the point that they can no longer be listed on the Endangered Species Act. When that proposed action and biological assessment are completed, and that is what Reclamation is expecting to finish up in the very near future, they then go to what are known as the services, as Chairman mentioned, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is, for very complex and stupid historical reasons, the agency that has jurisdiction over Chulmunkaptu, and then the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is really the more confusing one because they're actually housed in the Department of Commerce for no good reason, that has jurisdiction over the coho salmon. The services then do their own evaluations of Reclamation's action and biological assessment and issue their own biological opinions, which are the governing documents under the Endangered Species Act that set the baseline requirements that Reclamation will need to meet if it is not going to violate the Endangered Species Act. And so for purposes of the Chulmunkaptu and the Fish and Wildlife Service biological opinion, that's where the lake level elevations became really important for the litigation that we won. But ultimately, they're really important because they are tied to the biological needs of the species and making sure that they have the protections that they need so that they can do their best to reproduce and survive and therefore not go extinct.
Thanks for that, Jay. I think it's probably important to say part of what I like about what we've been hearing from the services as far as what a new biological opinion might look like conceptually. One of the things that the Klamath tribes, as well as the downriver tribes, have argued is that we've got to start thinking about this as one big ecosystem, an ecosystem that runs from the headwaters up here in our homeland all the way out to the ocean. And so we've got to think about what was here and how it functioned before the project, before the Sprague was straightened by the Army Corps of Engineers, before 80% of the wetlands were drained and diked, before the dams were in there, before we had all the degradation of riparian areas on our streams by uncontrolled cattle grazing, which has resulted in phosphorus loading into the lake and toxic algae blooms. So there's a whole lot of history that has gone into creating a really dismal state for our ecosystem. And if we want to think in a smart way going forward, we've got to start trying to manage it by heading back toward what was here. No one thinks we can go all the way back to the 19th century. But for example, if we can keep east side water pouring down on the east side into those refuges, if we can create wetlands and in particularly the Agency Barnes 14,000-acre reconnection project that I want to talk about in a moment, so that we're holding water in Klamath Lake much later in the year and permanently begin to shrink the size of the project to something that can hopefully be sustaining or self-sustaining going forward. Those are all good things, and those are things that we want to try to do, and that I think the way of thinking that's headed toward this now new set of biological opinions is doing. But at the same time, in the short term, and by short term I mean 5 to 10 years, while this restoration work is taking place, when we get to a point where things are more healthy up here, we've got to keep our fish from going extinct. And of course, the downriver tribes are thinking in the same way. So there's a kind of a zero-sum game going on. It's as if we're all backed into a corner and we're trying to do our best to protect our own interests. And I think that this discussion about the minimums in the lake for the spawning level are indicative of that. Now, I do want to point out, I think folks have probably read this in the tribal newspaper, there is a reconnection of what we're calling Agency Barnes, which is on the northwest side of the lake. It's 14,000 acres. It's a wetland that was there connected to the lake historically. It will reconnect both 4 Mile and 7 Mile creeks, which are spring-fed, cold, clean water. It will provide a nursery for our juvenile Tuam and Koptu, which is a big part of the problem that we're having. Biologists talk about what they call recruitment, which means that our hatchlings do not make it to sexual maturity. So it's the juvenile Tuam and Koptu that are not making it to the later life stages. And these new wetlands are these replacing, putting these wetlands back, hopefully will help with that. Now, obviously, refilling 14,000 acres of wetland means that there is, in the short term, going to be less water going out toward the river or toward the project. So part of what we've been worrying about is being told that we're not going to have the levels we need for the east side spring spawning in the lake if we push forward with this reconnection of those wetlands in Agency Barnes. And indeed, I'm still concerned about that we really need both. And there's what's called a NEPA process. And Jay, I might ask you to talk about that in a moment, that any project that's going to have impacts, not just to the natural world, but to the human world, has to go through. And at this point, the Agency Barnes NEPA process has been satisfied by what's called a finding of no significant impact, or a FONSI. But it's possible that the irrigators could challenge that if we insist on having lake levels that we think are biologically necessary for spawning at the same time as we insist on filling up that 14,000 acres. So where did I go wrong with that description, Jay?
Once again, Chairman, I think you nailed it. I think that was exactly right. So under the National Environmental Policy Act, which is, it's a procedural statute, not a substantive one. And so under NEPA, you do not have to come out with a specific outcome. It's different than the Endangered Species Act that way, which really does require you to do specific real world things for endangered species. NEPA is about making sure that a government agency takes a hard look at the potential effects of its actions so that the agency and stakeholders and the general public can be well informed of potential consequences whenever a decision to move forward with something is made. And so Chairman's description of the NEPA process for Agency Barnes is exactly right, that there are sort of different levels of scrutiny that get applied under NEPA depending on how an agency, and in this case it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that would be responsible for managing the reconnection, assesses the level of impact to both the human and ecological environment that it expects might occur from a particular activity. And this is true whether those effects might be negative, or as in the case of Agency Barnes, where they are unquestionably going to be hugely important and beneficial for the ecosystem, even where they're positive, it's the obligation of the agency to do an assessment of those effects. And as I said, there are a couple of different levels of scrutiny. There is a lower level of scrutiny when an agency makes a determination that the activity will not have significant effects on the environment. And it makes that determination in a document known as an environmental assessment. And if it publishes the environmental assessment and receives comments on it and then determines, yep, we don't see any significant impacts, it issues exactly what Chairman said, which is what happened with Agency Barnes, which is a finding of no significant impact. If, however, it does an environmental assessment and determines that there may be significant effects, or even just from the get-go, if an agency knows that something it wants to do is going to have significant effects, under NEPA, it needs to prepare a more robust document, which is known as an environmental impact statement, which takes a more granular look and has to identify and do more analysis, takes more time, costs more money to prepare for the agency than an EA, an environmental assessment, does. And so ultimately, and we think this was an entirely appropriate decision given the overwhelmingly positive and beneficial environmental effects that will flow from the Agency Barnes reconnection. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here did an EA FONSI to comply with its NEPA obligations. And what Chairman was referencing is that, you know, anyone with the fee to pay the court filing can file a lawsuit. And there are, you know, there is the risk that if the irrigators really wanted to thwart this, which we think would be a very counterproductive step on their part, ultimately they make their own decisions, they might choose to challenge and to delay Fish and Wildlife Service's efforts to reconnect Agency Barnes by arguing in court that Fish and Wildlife Service should have conducted an environmental impact statement, an EIS, rather than going the EA FONSI route. And so that's the litigation risk the Chairman was referring to.
Thanks, Jay. I wonder if we could talk just a little bit more about some of the modeling changes that I at least think are very progressive. And one of those is thinking back to some of the struggles that we've had in the past, where we've got this very degraded ecosystem that is very the hydrologists call flashy, meaning that if we have a snowpack and then we get a warm spell, that melt happens very quickly. In a more healthy ecosystem, what would happen is that water would be naturally stored. It would be stored in the floodplains and the tributaries above the lake. It would be stored in a more healthy upland forest ecosystem with wet meadows. So the restoration work that we're trying to do, including the reconnection of Agency Barnes, is about trying to get away from that flashiness, to restore some of the capacity of the ecosystem to hold water longer and later in the year above the lake and around the lake. So without that kind of healthy ecosystem in place, we get pressure from the downstream tribes who have already said are worried about coho, and rightly so, because they'll say, gee, look, we've got this snowpack, you know, the There's plenty of water up above, so why don't we put more water in the river? And hopefully with the dams out, there's not going to be the same pressure to have these what they called flushing flows to take away the parasites which were gathered up below the dams. So one of the ways that I think this model is an improvement is that it doesn't simply rely on a single national weather forecasting agency. And it also does a better job of considering all of the moisture that's in the environment up above. And Jay, I'm fumbling this a little bit. I wonder if you could help with that more complex model for considering how much water, how much moisture there is actually up above.
Absolutely. And so what Chairman is getting at is that under Reclamation's prior plan for managing the irrigation project, it made water allocation decisions both to the project and then also for the amount of water it was going to push out of Upper Klamath Lake for river flows based on a specific forecast produced by the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is an agency housed in the Department of Agriculture that does, you know, a lot of good work on water forecasting. But essentially, every year on April 1st, they were looking at what the NRCS projected as the average amount of water that might come into Upper Klamath Lake during the subsequent months in the April to September period, basically, and saying, okay, since we expect this much water is going to come in, we're going to let the project have this much water and push this much water to the river, and then the lake gets what's left over. And the difficulty is that forecasting is just that, they're a guess. And while they can be based on the best possible data, particularly where with climate change, we are conducting a real-time biological and ecological experiment where forecasts, which are built on past history and how things worked in the past to be able to make future predictions from, are really breaking down. And so one of the things that we think is very encouraging in the new approach that it sounds like Reclamation is going to take for some of its water allocation decisions is that instead of using this one forecast at this single moment in time, they will be looking at multiple forecasts and they will be using some more conservative assessments rather than just sort of this is what we think the average will be. Instead, we think, you know, look, this is in prior years, if we had this much water at this time, we think this might be a worse year that we will see coming in, to make those decisions about when and what kind of quantities it will push water out to project irrigators or to the river. And what's really important about that is, as Chairman said, you know, when water is short, we have essentially a zero-sum game. Either it can stay in the lake for Tuam and Koptu, it can go to the river for Coho, or it can go to the project for farming. And more conservative assessments earlier in the season, when we don't know what kind of water year that it is going to shape up to be, ultimately are more likely to be protective of Tuam and Koptu needs, because once that water leaves the lake, we can't get it back.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jay. I also thought, Ken, I might run through a little bit of what the Klamath tribes and some of the other tribes are involved with, referring back to that $72 million that's the first installment for this restoration work. Yeah, so there's $2 million that are coming directly to the Klamath tribes for the Upper Williamson River, and that's really about the marsh. Tribal members know that the marsh is not functioning in the way that it did historically and the way that it needs to again. Neither the Sycan nor the Klamath Marsh, for that matter, are functioning as they should. So this will be for our folks to do restoration work up there, reconnecting floodplains, trying to do some things to get that marsh back into condition that it needs to be, although there's a whole host of other problems up there that we still are not able to address, one of which is groundwater pumping that is a problem up at the marsh. There's also $1 million coming for further work in the Bootleg Fire Scar. Our restoration crew, our Ombudot restoration crew, has already done some amazing work on Green Diamond Land in the Bootleg Fire Scar. And we've seen in 1 year, a real return to health up there. And that's come not just from doing work to put the channels back into shape that they should be, but also by fencing out cattle. In addition, there is $4 million for the Agency Barns project that we've already talked about. That's not coming directly to the tribes, but of course we're involved with that. There's another $1.8 million that the Klamath tribes are partnering with the Yurok tribe and with the Klamath Drainage District. This is one that I'm really excited about, and it's still at the feasibility study stage. But basically what this would do is it would reconnect what was Lower Klamath Lake to the river. In other words, there's a little piece of real estate down there called the Klamath Straits where water used to be connected, the river and Lower Klamath Lake. This would reconnect the Klamath National Wildlife Refuge, which is a portion of what Lower Klamath Lake once was. This is important for a couple of reasons. As we've been saying, right, wetlands are the way that the ecosystem stores water naturally, holds moisture much longer and later into the year, essentially big sponges that absorb water in the winter and then release it slowly in the summer. We know that there were springs there along the river that haven't been functioning that we hope will come back. But by and large, what we're looking to do from the perspective of the Klamath tribes is to take pressure off of the lake, so that the water that is in the river is not simply coming out of the lake, but has that increased storage capacity further down in the ecosystem. So we're very excited about that. We're also very excited about the coordination with Klamath Drainage District. Here are some farmers and some irrigators who are recognizing that we've got to put some of this ecosystem back the way that it once was, and they're adjusting farming practices, doing things as far as when they irrigate and the kinds of crops that they grow, experimenting with what they call cover crops. So we're really excited about the potential there. There's also another $6 million that will be spent in the Upper Sprague. And this is with a group of landowners. I think a lot of people know Becky Hyde, Larry Nicholson. They are up there doing their best to get cooperation from landowners to restore floodplains. There's also some money here for trying to recruit landowners that may not yet be on board with this. I don't know what that's going to look like yet, and I don't think they do. Obviously, you know, we have some concerns about that, and we'll just continue to pay close attention. Some of our members, I'm sure, have heard about this MOU, this Memorandum of Understanding that was signed recently by ourselves, the Yurok, the Karuk tribes, and the Klamath Water Users Association and the Department of Interior. This is really an agreement to try to agree. But I think more importantly, as I said, it's a recognition that the way forward comes from restoration, comes from putting some semblance of health back to the ecosystem so that all of us can go forward together. And it's also the avenue that's turned loose these dollars. So $72 million is the first installment. We have got some significant requests already in front of Department of Interior to grow our capacity with our OMBODOT department. We've also got our Natural Resources Department involved because we understand the connections, again, between upland forests and the aquatic ecosystem. So that's what that MOU was about, and that's why we were so involved with it.
Very good. A lot we covered today in this podcast with Chairman Clay Dumont and Jay Weiner, the water attorney for the Klamath Tribes, as we call him. Chairman, thank you. That is a lot of information. This is recorded so people can listen again to grasp it all, because it's going to take more than one listen, I think.
And I apologize. It is very complicated stuff. I know it's a steep learning curve, and thank goodness for Jay to help me and the other council members as we tangle with this. But as always, tribal members can call me, right? Call me, send me an email. I always set aside time on Fridays to sit with tribal members. So be glad to talk in depth if some of this was confusing.
And Jay, I know you have a busy schedule. Thanks for taking the time today to talk to the tribes on this podcast.
It's absolutely my pleasure, Ken. Again, I really just wanted to reiterate my thanks and appreciation for Chairman Dumont's kind words about me, and that it really is an honor and a privilege to be able to work on the tribe's behalf. So I'm delighted to have this opportunity to try as best I can to explain some of the fairly complicated things that I do on the tribe's behalf.
You've been listening to the Klamath Tribe's weekly podcast, which you can hear on YouTube and our own news website, klamathtribesnews.org. I'm Ken Smith. We'll talk again next week.